Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. I am Matt Sainsbury. I'm the editor-in-chief at digitallydownloaded.net. And with me this week, we've got the New Zealand team. We've got Ginny.
Hey.
And Matt.
Hello.
So we've got a lot to talk about this week. It's going to get feisty, but we'll start with a bit of happy music to put everyone in a good mood. Welcome back. That was some Hatsune Miku music, because we always start the podcast that way. You should be getting used to that by now. Sorry if you don't like Hatsune Miku, you just have to live with it. But who doesn't like Hatsune Miku? You're a bit wrong. It must be Alan. He's not even here, but I'm still mocking him. Okay, so this week there was some pretty big news that came towards the end of the week. In Australia, Outlast 2, which was a fairly high-profile horror game in development, it must be said, that game was banned for reasons. As usual, the classification board was pretty vague on it at first, but later on we kind of got a sense that the main reason for it was one particular scene which had, you know, sexual violence and all that kind of stuff that the Australian censors do not like. It's disappointing. We keep talking about censorship because it keeps happening, but you would think that a game like that, as uncomfortable as the content might be, would get through on an R18 rating, because that's the point of having the R18 rating in the first place. I haven't seen the scene, I must admit, that the game was supposedly banned for. From what I've read about it, it sounds pretty uncomfortable. I wasn't particularly looking forward to Outlast 2 anyway, because I wasn't a big fan of the first Outlast. It's not the kind of horror that I find particularly engaging, but, you know, it's on principle, I have issues with censorship. Ginny, what were your thoughts about all of this nonsense, given that, you know, it seems more likely that might be banned in New Zealand as well now?
I don't know if it's going to be banned in New Zealand, mainly because I think we have a pretty blasé attitude towards graphic violence of any sort. I think in terms of what's being banned in New Zealand, I think they see depictions of, and obviously this isn't my own opinion, but they see depictions of, things that might have an impact on the moral fabric of their society by their reckoning would not be okay. So things like pedophilia especially is a hot button, I think, for censorship. Just reading through the Gun Gal notes, obviously the commission's decision, a big part of why they chose to ban a game like Gun Gal wasn't just sexualization of women. It was specifically the sort of skirting the edge of the underage element in the game. But I mean, you see games like Gears of War, whereby you're like graphically dismembering someone. And by all accounts, I mean, the beginning of Outlast 2 seems to start the same way. You're graphically dismembering some part of yourself. Don't want to go into too many spoilers here. No one's played it yet. Not that we'll get to play it here, maybe. But I think in terms of violence and graphic in-your-face violence, I think New Zealand seems to not really care as much as when you skirt that line of possible sexual deviancy where there's a problem. So I can see where I think Outlast 2 might run up against the wall, because it is, I suppose, a depiction of sexual violence. But I mean, it just, in terms of what the New Zealand Censorship Board, I think, is going to do about it, I think from a legal perspective, the jurisdiction and the law that governs censorship across New Zealand and Australia is incredibly vague. I think we've all made observations sort of to this extent, noting that most of the discretion is up to these individuals on the board. And so obviously I can't speak for, you know, whichever Tom, Dick or Harry is going to look at Outlast 2 over here and go, is this okay or not? But I definitely think that just in terms of making a broad statement on censorship in Australia and New Zealand in general, obviously, I don't live in Australia, but I can definitely see that a real issue is how the courts and the law will interpret the supporting or promoting of, let's say, morally unconscionable material. And so I guess Outlast 2, they've decided that the sexual violence scene is promoting morally unconscionable material, which is all well and good. But I think that Outlast 2, while it has that, it shouldn't be banned. It should not have been banned. I know that we've talked about this before. I am very anti-censorship, despite coming from a country where censorship is all the rage. Well, that might have been part of it, really. But I think if material is objectionable, that's fine. It still has a right to exist. And while I obviously don't condone sexual violence, and it'd be ridiculous for anyone to assume that I condone sexual violence, I feel like a game is more than just the sum of its parts. And this is just one small part that the board should not have made an overarching decision on. And I mean, how do you guys feel about, I suppose, the presence of objectionable content in games and whether or not that justifies a ban, let's say like a flat ban.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I don't believe that government bodies should censor content in any way, shape or form, unless the production of that content itself is breaking laws. I've had this discussion with other people in the past, but for example, a film in which somebody is actually killed, a snuff film, that would be obviously something that needs to be censored, and the people who made that obviously need to be thrown in prison as well. But the depiction of it, I don't believe should ever be censored, because I think censorship is a very dangerous path to go down under any circumstances, because there is always going to be an element of subjectivity involved in it. So, if what one person finds completely offensive, another person won't, or another person might engage with on a level where they derive some kind of meaning from either being offended by or criticizing it in the first place. So to talk about Outlast 2 being the topical one, I completely understand that people would be very offended by the kind of content that's in that game. But other people, A, aren't going to be offended by it. B, would use it as a good opportunity to have a real discussion about the depiction of those kinds of contents in a game. So what happens is, if you censor something, nobody gets to play it, no one gets to experience it, nobody actually gets to critique it. And I think that is a lost opportunity to have discussions about where limits are in society and what we as a society need to discuss about these kinds of things. So that's kind of where I stand. Censorship under all circumstances is no good as far as I'm concerned.
I think we should just ban everything that isn't Hatsune Miku.
Yeah, that would work too. Everyone should play it, so we're getting everyone to play it.
But on a more serious note, I think, I largely agree with both of you. I think it's a very... When you start banning stuff because of depiction of something objectionable, that is a very dangerous line to tread, I think, because it limits the possibility of art, whether it's like games or movies or whatever kind of art it is, it limits the possibilities to actually explore those themes in any kind of meaningful, productive way. And I mean, I don't know, having not played Outlast 2, I don't know if it really does, if there is any kind of artistic merit to it. And from reading the description of that scene, it kind of doesn't sound like it. But that's a very subjective thing and not something that I think should be... It's not something that a government agency should be making a decision on behalf of everyone else.
Well, the lack of artistry in it would also be, something worth discussing. The gratuitousness of the scene, if it lacks artistic credibility, is certainly something that needs to be discussed. And again, we can't do it because we can't play it, can't experience it, we can't put it in context of the whole game. Even if we go and watch a YouTube clip of that particular scene, we're not seeing it in the context and we're not being the participant in the game, which is obviously what you need to do to get the full impact of a game. So... I mean, to give another example, and this is kind of an extreme example, but I think it kind of will explain the point a bit. I find, and I know you do as well, Matt, and I know you would as well, Ginny, if you actually played it. But I find Ghost Recon Wildlands to be very offensive. The material in that game offends my kind of core moral values. And obviously that doesn't apply to everyone. This is a blockbuster game. A lot of people are playing it. A lot of people are having a great time with it. And I'm not suggesting that they shouldn't. But for them, if we're banning things based on the offense they caused, then we would need to ban this game because, it offends me and some other people. And obviously we can't do that. So to suggest that, just because it might offend a few more people in the case of Outlast 2, it therefore needs to be banned, again, just it's a very slippery slope, because when where do you draw the line? Where do you stop banning content? How many people need to be offended before something gets banned? It's just too subjective. It's nonsense.
I think, that it's a very difficult line to draw where, and I don't know how much this applies to Australia, but where the line tries to be drawn in New Zealand is whether the work is encouraging, like promoting or supporting this kind of behavior. And that was the argument made with Galgan, was that it's not just depicting what in the censorship board's view was pedophilia, but it's promoting and encouraging it, which I think in that example is ridiculous. I think that on a theoretical level, that's a good line to draw because of the, how do I phrase this? The possibility of releasing something that then is of such an influence on the audience that it encourages people to go out and commit crimes, or even on a desensitizes to them so that it becomes less of an issue. I'm losing my words a bit, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean,
in practical terms, I can't think of anything that really does that, except maybe, and this comes back to, is something like Ghost Recon Wildlands or Call of Duty, or that with all the sort of nationalist military propaganda, I think that has a much bigger potential for being harmful in its influence over society than something like Outlast 2.
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue I have with the way that New Zealand does that is that, you know, once you've been desensitized to something, then you're obviously no longer going to be sensitive to it. Therefore, the content can be, you know, more extreme and more potentially damaging without anybody really noticing, which is obviously what happens with nationalist stuff, because, you know, people are generally pretty desensitized to nationalist stuff. Also violence, you know, if you're gonna suggest that games can cause people to do very horrible things, and, you know, there's research out there that suggests that that is possible, fine. Then you got to look at how games like Mortal Kombat are actually allowed to exist, and kind of question that. So I'm not sure I buy that argument. In Australia, I believe that it's a very simple, you know, reasonable adult litmus test. So, you know, what a reasonable adult would think about content. And that's got a whole different, you know, bundle of issues that I'm not even going to try and unpack in this podcast, but suffice to say, I'm obviously not a reasonable adult. And welcome back. That was some music from Nier, which came out on PC this week, and everyone's complaining about the frame rates rather than actually talking about the game itself. Silly people. Okay, so this, given that we were talking about some pretty controversial stuff in the first section, we thought we'd continue that trend and talk about something a little bit different from games, actually, to start with. There was a film that's kind of making the rounds at the moment, a Korean film called The Handmaiden, and it is proving to be a very popular with the kind of artsy-fartsy people that like going to films that don't star Avengers. And yeah, I mean, Ginny, you've seen the film. It's obviously particularly well known at the moment because it does eroticism very well, something that is a bit of a dying art in film. But yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts about that film?
Well, I have enjoyed lots of Park Chan-wook's films. He's the guy that directed Old Boy and Stoker, just for everyone out there who is probably familiar with those two, but not familiar with The Handmaiden per se. So I've always been a fan of his filming style. So funnily enough, he did Snowpiercer, which has Chris Evans in it, aka Captain America. But it's, I think in terms of eroticism in films, I'm going to, obviously, full disclosure, am Asian, just in case people were wondering. And I have seen, I would like to say, a variety of cinema, both across Asian produced cinema and Western produced cinema. And I would definitely say, in terms of handling eroticism, films like The Handmaiden and lots of, I would say, category three Chinese films, which are sort of like, according to their censorship board, triple X films, but rather would be NC-17 films in the West. I would say the handling of eroticism in Asian films is more nuanced, I would say, than what's sort of targeted at a Western audience in traditional Western films. And I think the main reason for this actually is censorship, I think. Historically, films that contain sexual material have always been, films that have promoted a particular sort of sexual material, sexual lifestyle, sexual act have always been very heavily censored. So when you're framing eroticism and erotic acts in Asian cinema, I would say that there has to be a level of artistry almost to sort of like slip it by the censorship board. You've got to like sort of mask the layers of sexuality and eroticism and sort of alternative perspectives in high art, or at least the trappings of high art. And I think for a long time that produced lots of sort of softcore, lushly filmed, sort of barely veiled pornography out of China and Korea as well, just sort of as a way of, I think, spitting in the face of censorship. I think the West is sort of loath to acknowledge that Asia is actually quite sexually liberated in terms of the material that it produces. Movies like The Handmaiden, for example, I think, obviously, to bring it back to what we're talking about, how it does eroticism very well is that eroticism is actually the focus of the movie. As a viewer, it's always there. You're not sort of like panning away to sort of like a shadily shot lesbian sex scene. You know, like the focus of the entire movie is a very real, very intimate female-on-female relationship. And the byproduct of that is that the whole movie is framed in that way, from the sort of like sparse cinematography to the very, very sort of deliberate framing of men from certain camera angles, and also the partitioning of men and women in the movie through the use of sets, through the use of lighting. I think that in terms of eroticism, what The Handmaiden does so well is it never tries to hide anything. It's sort of like a game of, I would say Asia has turned the game of hide and seek in terms of censorship and sex into an art form almost. The way that The Handmaiden deals with sex and homosexuality is very open about the subjects it's dealing with, but at the same time, I think it's a representation that isn't cartoonish. It's not overly sexualized. It's not you know, it's not like lesbian porn for men. And I think that the dealing in terms of when you're looking at sexuality and how it's dealt with in Asian film, I think over time we've had all these decades to, I would say, think about how we represent stuff. We can't just throw it out there to the wide world. You know, you're facing sort of, you're facing government disapproval, if you're facing government exile for some of the more outspoken artists. And I think that these decades of having to deal with censorship requirements have actually made us think a lot more about the kind of sex we want represented and how to do justice to that. Because if you're just going to make a movie and have it banned by the government, why bother? You know, like, you need to think about these things first. You need to think through how you depict sex, how you depict homosexuality. I think The Handmaiden is a really prime example of modern Korean and modern Asian cinema, where you can tackle these issues that the government finds repulsive or undesirable and make them into an incredibly acclaimed movie, I think, because that's what's important.
Yeah, I think I think the social angle is certainly one of the key reasons that Asian cinema and eroticism survives, where it's like I said at the start, it's a dying art in the West. Obviously, the audiences in these markets are more receptive to this kind of thinking and this kind of being. While I haven't seen The Handmaiden quite a few years ago now, when I was at university, I was studying a film called Lies, which is also a Korean film based on a book that was actually banned in Korea, that depicts a lot of it's an S&M relationship, and the film doesn't hold back in any way either, and it was just fascinating to see, you know, how these films are constructed in such a way that it's not gratuitous, that it is actually, you know, important to the narrative. The narrative is actually built around it, and that the way it's used in these artworks is actually to further that narrative, as opposed to, you know, being thrown in there for the purposes of titillation, which tends to happen when you've got, you know, sexual themes going through Western films. To I guess bring it to games, the reason we're kind of talking about this earlier in the week was that there is that sense that games aren't quite up to that point at all yet, where they can kind of really handle sexual themes in a mature and nuanced way as they do in film at the moment. So the idea of, you know, erotic games are either, you know, quite kind of silly nonsense, anime games often, visual novels, not that I don't like them or anything, but yeah, they're not quite up to the artistry of stuff like The Handmaiden. And yeah, it's a good discussion to have. You know, what point do we think that games will get up to that standard? When will games be able to start handling those themes in a mature way? Is what if anything is kind of holding them back at the moment? So I know, Matt, you had thoughts around this topic in general. So, you know, what's your take on it all?
Well, I haven't seen The Handmaiden or any of those sorts of movies, really. But one thing that this all makes me think of is a game called Lady Killer in a Bind, which I don't know if either of you have played. And that was a game that got a lot of attention a couple of months ago because it got released on Steam, despite having very explicit sexual content and despite Steam's standard practice of not allowing explicitly sexual games to be released. And the reason for that is that basically the creator, Christine Love, spoke to people at Steam and was like, hey, it is a very sexual game, but it's also, that's the point, it's an exploration of sexuality, and specifically a kind of S&M relationships. And it does that really, perhaps not with the same kind of high art approach as something like The Handmaiden, but it's very mature and nuanced. It approaches these ideas and takes them seriously, but also not at the same time, if that makes sense. It kind of it explores the very serious issues of sexuality, but also the human element and the way that it's kind of can be quite comical in a way. And I think it walks that tightrope quite well. And yeah, I think that feeds into the issue that games have with approaching this kind of stuff is just from a platform perspective, how difficult it is just to get them published. If it was somebody else who doesn't have the kind of influence that Christine Love has, would they have been able to get that on Steam? Probably not. Will we ever see games like that on consoles, with how rigidly Sony and Xbox sort of control that kind of content? I don't know. That's not something I see happening very soon, and I think that's the biggest roadblock.
Yeah, I certainly think that's, I mean, one of the things that the film industry obviously enjoys is a very robust art house scene where you've got film festivals and you've got distributors and distribution methods that don't necessarily rely on going through gatekeepers that are trying to make their product, you know, something for everybody and good fun for the whole family. So there is that issue that the films industry, being a much more mature industry and being a much larger industry, has got the capabilities to have that kind of content in such a way that, you know, as far as the gatekeepers are all concerned, it's not going to compromise the rest of the industry in the views of those conservative people that just don't want to see this kind of stuff. The games industry could certainly use, I don't know, it'd be great if there was like a hardware maker out there somewhere that was willing to pull together a box that wasn't going to sell as well, but was going to be more open to this kind of content, you know, call it the art house game box or whatever you want to call it. That's a pretty good name, actually. And that would certainly be a step in the right direction, I think. There are other issues, you know, I would argue that most of the writers out there aren't quite up to the scratch to handle this kind of content in a way that would give it the respect it needs. I think also the fact that games are interactive is still proving a problem for a lot of narrative writers. And when you start getting into very deeply personal stuff like sex, and very potentially emotionally affecting stuff like that, the interactivity of games needs to be addressed. And you can't just do it, obviously, by making it a cutscene, because then there's interactivity on either side of it that needs to be fed into the cutscene as well. So those are issues that the industry is still grappling with. The film industry did the same thing back in the 40s and 30s and whatever, when it was a maturing industry. So there's hope yet, but yeah, for now, we've got to rely on pioneers like Christine Love to continue to do their thing, and hopefully make enough money for it that they can continue to do their thing until the rest of the industry kind of starts to catch up. And welcome back. That was some music from Lady Killer in a Bind. Beyond the good stuff that we were talking about in the last section, this is a really good indie game. So and very different. So play it if you like variety and you want to see the where exactly games can be very artful. Give this game a go. We do highly recommend it. Okay, so for the last section, since we're talking about cinema, we thought we'd have a little bit of a chat about another Asian, well, should have been Asian film, and another topic to do with film that we do feel crosses over into games as well. And that film is Ghost in the Shell, which is it out yet? Is it out soon?
Soon, I think.
Soon,
not out
whenever.
In New Zealand anyway.
Anyway, not exactly interested in the film, to be honest, because reasons. No, the main problem obviously is that they've, of all the many talented actors that they could have chosen from Japan, let alone the rest of Asia, they decide to pick a white girl to play a role in a very Japanese story. And, you know, that film in many ways epitomizes the issue that the ongoing issue that Hollywood has with whitewashing, which is, you know, when you take a character that should be of an ethnic group and then decide to cast a white person to play that role, happens all the time in Hollywood films. For some reason, it's happening more and more often in films that have Asian investment. God knows why anyone thought it would be a good idea to stick Matt Damon and Willem Dafoe on The Great Wall, but they did, and that was pretty poor. And now they've done it with Scarlett Johansson, who is generally a nice, a great actor, but yeah, her excuses for being in that film are pretty terrible. And then, of course, you know, looking at TV as well, there's been the controversy about Iron Fist as well. There's probably room to have more Asian actors in that one, and they didn't. So, yeah, I mean, I've talked about whitewashing in cinema often enough on Twitter that people keep yelling at me about it. What are your thoughts about it, Ginny?
Well, in terms of Ghost in the Shell, well, I have a lot of thoughts. This is probably going to become one of those Ghost Recon Wildlands type rants that happened on the last podcast, which are 100% justified. I like to believe that my concerns are as well. Maybe it's just because there's been like a dearth of whitewashing movies in, you know, the past couple of months. We're thinking Aloha, that movie with Emma Stone where she was playing a Japanese character, I believe, an American Japanese character, despite, you know, retaining her incredibly blonde hair and her incredibly fair complexion and her complete lack of acknowledgement of, you know, the character or her character's alleged Asian American heritage. And then we had obviously Matt Damon's The Great Wall, which was a great way for the rest of the world to be introduced to the Great Wall via Matt Damon and a dragon, dragon dinosaur creatures. You know, obviously, definitely valuing the Great Wall as a very meaningful and controversial historical monument. And now I think Ghost in the Shell, it's less about, I think for me, it's more personal just because obviously I grew up reading Ghost in the Shell. And in my mind, and I think objectively in many people's minds, there was no doubt that she was, that the Major is a Japanese character. You know, it's there in the Major's name, you know, Motoko Kusanagi, she's Japanese. And I think in terms of how she was drawn, how she was depicted, and how obviously the other characters in the entire series were depicted, this is a Japanese series with Japanese characters in Japan. That is how I think Ghost in the Shell had historically always been received. Obviously, there are people out there that didn't receive it that way. I actually do want to know what you thought was going on. I do want to know what you were thinking when you read that series and you thought, this is in no way indicative of being, you know, of representing Japanese characters in a Japanese setting. I actually am quite curious as to know how people saw it in a different light. But aside from that, I think that the whitewashing of Ghost in the Shell, I think at this point in history, at this particular time, in this particular climate politically, I think it's incredibly offensive and incredibly intolerable, just because I think we're reaching sort of like, I wouldn't say like a group awareness, but I would say that when there's constant outcry about race representation, and when queer people, people of color, people who are minorities are very concerned with being represented and vocally voicing these concerns, to have them completely ignored by Hollywood continuously, even in this day and age of, a liberal climate in America, I think it's incredibly damning. And I think I am 100% against this whitewashing. So.
Yeah. Very much in agreement. One thing I find interesting, and that's maybe not the right choice of word, is that the whitewashing, from what I've read in Ghost in the Shell, is kind of built into the story, and that Major is initially Japanese, and then something happens, and for some reason her consciousness gets transported into a white person's body. Oh. But she's still the Japanese person on the inside.
Okay.
Oh, that's even worse.
And she speaks Japanese, but suddenly when she gets put into a white person's body, everyone just starts speaking English and the whole Japanese element. And I mean, God. Maybe if it was trying to make some sort of thematic exploration of whitewashing, Ghost in the Shell probably isn't the right avenue for that anyway, but I'm gonna just go ahead and assume that that's not what it's trying to do, and it's just kind of a fun little plot point to explain why she's not Japanese anymore, but she actually really is on the inside.
I mean, I've read some reviews of The Great War, which kind of argue that it's subtly subversive to the whole whitewashing thing, and if that's the intent of it, and I wouldn't it may well have been, the director of The Great Wall is actually, you know, very pro-China nationalist kind of guy himself. He's a wonderful director, and he's actually films that you would have to say are a kind of propaganda for the Chinese government. So there is the chance that that's there, but nonetheless, I mean, we're talking about an issue that flies over the heads of a lot of people, especially in the West. So if you're going to go and position these films as what they are, you're going to have to assume that people aren't going to get the kind of subtle messages that you might want to get across in them, and therefore your attempt, noble as it might have been, will kind of fail. And I think that's probably going to be the case with any social commentary around whitewashing that they might have thrown in to Ghost in the Shell to explain it. Realistically, I think with that film, it was more probably Scarlett Johansson will give us X amount of dollars if she's in the film, so let's get her in. But yeah, I think I've lost my train of thought. I was going to say something. I was about to go on a great long rant. Yeah, lost it completely. I mean, I think the thing is that Hollywood, I mean, we saw it at the Oscars. Hollywood's really patting itself on the back at the moment for its efforts in improving diversity. And to a limited extent, it is doing that. The award winners in the Academy Awards this year were a much more diverse bunch, and that's great to see. But the thing is that this patting on the back for improving things is pretty unjustified, I think, because where Hollywood is doing great things in including especially African Americans and women into its films, it's not doing a great job with other minority groups. And, you know, Scarlett Johansson was out there talking about how her decision to take on this role in Ghost in the Shell was this great kind of feminist statement, and all that is all well and good, but it's also ignoring the fact that you could have cast a Japanese woman in the same role and actually done a thing for diversity by doing that. So I think that this diversity argument, this diversity conversation needs to go a lot further than it is. So to quickly bring it back to games as well, I mean, how do people think that games are handling the diversity thing at the moment?
Well, if I can just present a bit of a thought experiment for you two. You've got, if say you've got a Ghost in the Shell game, and I think there have been some in the past, but let's say they made a new game to tie into the new film. Actually, no, that's a bad example. They made a new game based on the original anime, and so it's Japanese major, everything's all Japanese as it should be, and then for the localization of it, they need to translate the dialogue, and so they get a white American woman to do the voice acting. Is that whitewashing?
I don't think so, to be honest. I mean, that's basically happened in just about everything since ever with games industry. I mean, you look at my favorite game, Persona 4 or whatever. I play it in English because I like the dub of it. I like the voice actors they've got in for Persona 4, Laura Bailey and co. And it doesn't really, I mean, it doesn't strike me as whitewashing, mostly because the way that the Japanese do characters in games is pretty white anyway. The Japanese as a culture value whiteness in the skin. That's their idea of beauty anyway. That's the geisha and so on. So their games tend to be naturally, I don't want to say whitewash because that's the wrong word to use in this case, but their games tend to have characters that suit a Westerner's voice anyway. That I don't think that's an issue. I think it would be an issue for, I can't think of another example. I think the Japanese games industry is interesting with how it handles ethnicity, because Japan is such a monocultural society that they don't tend to think about these things. I've spoken to a lot of Japanese game developers about it. They just don't think about this stuff. And they just, all their characters, you look at all the games, that they're all quite, they're all just homogenous in terms of how they're ethnic, in terms of their ethnicity. You look at some of the big publishers now, like Square Enix with the African guy in Final Fantasy 13, and I hate myself for forgetting his name.
Zaz?
Yeah, that's him. Yeah, something like that. Some of the big publishers are starting to realize this because they've got that international exposure and they're trying to be a bit more diverse in how they do their characters. But for the most part, the Japanese just don't think about this. And I don't think they think that they're creating Japanese characters anyway. They just think they're making characters. They don't need to think about this. When you look at the West, because the West is a lot more multicultural, especially America, Australia, the UK, I think developers do need to take a lot more responsibility about this, because you can't just put white characters into everything. And then say, oh, yeah, but we didn't think about that. That's kind of what actually happened with Poland, with CD Projekt Red, with The Witcher, which is a little bit unfortunate because they are also a very monocultural society. But because they're part of Europe, you know, there's that expectation that they'll be a little bit more aware of, ethnic minorities. The problem I think games industry has is they don't tend to handle, when they do diversity, they tend to do it in a very kind of arbitrary way. I don't want to keep ragging on Horizon every week, but if you look at Horizon, the way it handles ethnicity is very arbitrary. It's just like, for some reason, you know, one character's black, another character's, you know, Asian looking, and they're in the same town, and there's no sense of culture about any of it. It's just, you know, let's just throw in all these different skin colors because that's the right thing to do, which is kind of step one, but you need to take step two and step three after that to kind of really get the diversity thing going.
Yeah, I think the reason I bring up the voice acting stuff is that there was all that controversy last year or the year before, whenever it was, prior to Uncharted 4 coming out, about the casting of Laura Bailey as, what's her name? Nadine Ross, who was the black South African mercenary, and all this talk about, well, why wasn't she? Why didn't you get a black South African woman to play her? And there are a lot of accusations of whitewashing there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. If you're going to make a character which is distinctly meant to be of an ethnic origin, then yes, you need to consider the voice actor. I feel that it would be appropriate if you're going to make a black character that you get a black voice actor for that. But, you know, the Japanese developers don't actually think about that. Their characters, you know, effectively have no ethnicity by design. You can get kind of any voice actor as long as it works for the character in to do that. Whether, you know, I do believe that Japan needs to be a lot more aware of this stuff and needs to, you know, the Japanese arts industry, film, games, all of that kind of thing, they do need to start taking a little bit more of an understanding approach towards diversity, especially since Japan itself desperately needs immigrants if it wants to not fall over in the future. So, you know, that's another talk for another day. But I think for now, there's a difference between how the Japanese think about you know, these things compared to how the West do.
I think I also just bring it back to the Ghost in the Shell game hypothetical situation where you would have Laura Bailey voicing the Major or another character. I would definitely say that because Ghost in the I would say, I mean, I would hope that the studio would come out with Japanese VO for this, you know, and then so they would have obviously Japanese VO actors, and you could, if you wanted to, have the Japanese VO with the subtitles for the most, I would say, true to the developer's experience of the game. I think as long as the original game is recorded with Japanese VO, and that is what is marketed and that is what is being sold, and the, I would say, the English VO is, you know, or the dub is an option, is a well-produced, well-thought-out option, keeping in mind how homogenous Japan society is, I think it's completely fine. I don't think that's whitewashing in the slightest. I'm very much of the same view that Matt has. I think coming from also a very homogenous Asian country, I recognize that in Chinese development too, you know, everyone in the Chinese game sort of looks like Lu Bu, but like a bit whiter, you know, like, it's just, that's just kind of how it is. Like, I mean, I love Dynasty Warriors, definitely, but lots of other Chinese studios doing MMORPGs, for example, have characters of indeterminate ethnicity and all have just sort of like the same bland, you know, sort of Eurasian voiceover for the English versions of the game. And I don't think that's whitewashing the slightest, so definitely that's how I would approach the hypothetical scenario.